We have several more announcements, but we also have speakers standing by and people who dialed in just to hear them. So we'll continue the announcements after this next segment of the call. Just note that the nominating committee has posted directions for applying for open board positions and upcoming deadlines on the text pad. You could fill out one of the leadership positions on our board and help shape Wilf's policies and strategic actions. But for now, on to our speakers. For decades, the United States government has overspent our tax dollars on weapons and equipment for its foreign wars. In recent years, they've bequeathed the leftover tanks, riot gear, rubber bullets, and tear gas to city police forces across America. Over time, police forces seem to also have relaxed recruiting standards and been infiltrated by white supremacists who employ violence and murder against people of color with impunity. We've witnessed the most violent, unnecessary, and indefensible police behaviors, but we've also witnessed an outpouring of public outcry from street demonstrators to basketball teams. Americans are sick to death of this war on people of color. Wilf members add their own outrage, and many of us have been out on the streets or supporting protesters in other ways. Amid a global pandemic, job closures, threats of evictions and foreclosures, and the continued vulnerability of frontline essential workers, mostly people of color, with too little protection and extremely low wages, Americans are insisting their cities defund the police. It's become a national campaign slogan. But what does that really look like? Without a broad federal policy, it looks different depending on where you are. And cities are at different points in their responses too. Louisville, Kentucky passed Breonna's Law to ban no-knock search warrants. New York State repealed parts of a provision that shields police job performance evaluations from the public. They also banned chokeholds and false race-based 911 calls. Their new provision appoints the state attorney general to be an automatic independent prosecutor in cases where officers shoot any unarmed person.
In Minneapolis, following the murder of George Floyd, the city promised to disband the police entirely and work with citizens to re-envision what safety looks like for everyone. In Washington, D.C., New York City, Sacramento, California, Seattle, Washington, and the state of New Jersey, other reforms are underway. Finally, we're seeing encouraging development pushed by broad public outcry. Not far from Kenosha, Wisconsin, the site of the latest shooting, one city has been hard at work to preemptively address police militarization and violence. In Madison, Wisconsin, a police reform committee met with the city council for 4 years and just recently completed its work, producing a total of 177 recommendations for reforming the local police department. Our guests tonight were involved in that effort and are here to describe the kinds of changes their cities plan envision, what kicked off their activism in this area years ago, and what they recommend for other cities plunged into the dark times of police violence. Their experiences can hold lessons for activists in other cities who want a way to shape, to help support policy changes that matter. Gisela Wilson is a member of Wilf Madison who joined the police reform effort in that city 2 years ago. Rebecca Kemble has been working with this city council committee for all 4 years. Amelia Royko-Maurer is co-founder of the Madison, Wisconsin Community Response Team, or CRT. Amelia may be joining us later to answer questions.
Welcome, Gisela and Rebecca. We'll start with you, Rebecca, because your involvement goes right back to the beginning 4 years ago. Can you tell us what kicked off this Madison Initiative in 2015 and how you became involved?
Sure. Thanks for inviting me to this call, and apologies preemptively if I drop off. I'm driving through the Black Hills where there is snow on the ground, believe it or not. So I actually wasn't on that committee. I'm an alder on the Madison City Council, and I was elected first in 2015. And right before my election, you know, yet another Black man was shot and killed by the Madison Police Department. Tony Robinson. His name was Tony Robinson. And this was the second kill that this particular officer had done. He got a Medal of Honor and commendation for his first kill, which was of a man who was experiencing a mental health crisis and had a toy gun, and he was in the middle of the road, and his wife was screaming from the porch, "It's a toy gun, he needs help." There were already two police officers at the scene trying to de-escalate, and then this officer, Matt Kenny, came in and just barreled through and shot him with a gun without even communicating with the other officers. Same situation with Tony Robinson. His friends had called the police for assistance because Tony had taken some mushrooms, some psilocybin, and was having a bad trip. And he was running in and out of traffic, and his friends called for help. And what Tony got was a bullet. And then what the family got was just years of attacks and gaslighting. And eventually they got a $3.35 million civil settlement. But that's because the Madison Police Department, the city of Madison, and our city attorney were so adamant that Matt Kenny was in the right, and they were not going to settle until it was shown in the civil case that Matt Kenny had lied multiple times about his story. Anyway, that was the incident that started my involvement, because that was right when I was elected. Immediately after that killing, the council formed this ad hoc committee to study Madison Police Department's policies and procedures. And that is the committee. It was a committee of all residents, and including at least one former police officer. But it was 11 residents who worked for 4 years, and with the assistance of we paid for an outside audit of the police department by an outfit that has a background in civil rights and understanding civil rights and law enforcement. And based on that report and their 4 years of work, we have these 177 recommendations, the most important of which was creating a position of the independent monitor and a civilian oversight board that we have just passed into law in Madison at our meeting on September 1st. So that's a little bit of, you know, how I got involved. I mean, we on the council have been subject to death threats, direct threats by a chief of police, direct threats in my home by the head of the police union. And it's been really tough but important work to do. And I think if it wasn't for the community support, organized support that Amelia and Gisela have been part of through the community response team and other Black movement organizations of town, there's no way we would be where we're at today. So thanks again for having me, and I'll turn it over to the next person.
Thanks, Rebecca. Gisela, I know that you're a member of Wilf Madison. Can you tell us how you got involved 2 years ago with this effort, and how much of the effort was our branch a party to, or were you at least keeping them informed?
Okay. Well, yes. I had been actually following the Black Lives Matter movement for quite some time, but not sure if I was going to stay in Madison. And once it became sure that I was going to stay, the first things I did was to look for my organizers of the movement, which is basically Freedom Inc., and also to look for Wilf. So I was in more direct contact with Wilf initially, but I invited one of the co-founders of Freedom Inc. To speak at one of our breakfasts that we have there. And immediately following that, Wilf had co-sponsored a big university presentation on restorative justice. And that showed a film, I forget its title now, Something Circles, about the mother of someone who was killed by another gang. And she was white. It was actually two segments, but same story. And their restorative journey. But after that, there was a roundtable discussion where our court-ordered restorative justice system brought a young girl who had forgotten her ID and typically walked through one of our shopping malls every day on her way to work. And she had, on that particular day, forgotten, for whatever reason, her ID. And this is, I think she was 17 years old or something like that. And for some reason, the cops harassed her enough so that she just bolted through the shopping mall to get to work. And then once she was in her place of employment, they tasered her and threw her in jail for the weekend. And this was part of her restorative process. So I was left, I have some background in restorative processes. And so I was just left with, she is presenting this against her will. And nobody's really addressing what the cops did wrong in that situation. And so one day when I got a call or an email from Amelia, actually, that was forwarded through our WILFnet network to show up because some of our white supremacists were coming to one of the ad hoc committee meetings, I jumped on board. And I've been pretty much on board ever since then. But if you're looking to start this, I would say connect with your local Black organizations. There surely have to be some. Try and figure out what they're asking for and do as much as you can to support that work. Wilf has done an amazing job. We're not directly involved in driving the protests. We've gone to a few of them. A lot of times what we're doing is sending letters to the city council or to the school board, or signing on to letters that others have written, for example, a recent letter to the Police and Fire Commission. If you're looking to get this started, what you'll do in your community is a little bit different than what we did because of differences in municipal and state laws. For example, in Wisconsin, we have a Police and Fire Commission that is totally responsible for hiring and firing any police officers. But up until now, they've really gotten a one-sided picture, solely the police department's view. And so this community oversight board and internal monitor were really important so that we can at least give them a much more even perspective on what happened in any particular circumstance. I doubt I'm under fire quite as much as anybody working in the government or as Amelia. Amelia's been in this since 2012. Tony Robinson was also killed in our neighborhood, but prior to that, one of her housemates, a musician, actually stumbled home being somewhat drunk late at night and walked in the door of the neighbor's house instead. And it being late at night, they called the police. And the police, I mean, it was their neighbor, but it was really late at night. And so the police came in and started and just fired at him, 5 or maybe even 7 gunshots, and killed them on the spot. And there was no discussion. So because of that, the community response team that Rebecca mentioned, even prior to the, had been formed even prior to the killing of Tony Robinson, and already had sort of run the gamut about all the loopholes and corners you had to turn to make any dent in the administration of this city. So
Amelia has joined the call. I wonder if we could ask her. Amelia, thank you for being here. And I wondered, when this initiative first took off, were you taken seriously? I mean, how did you get the attention of the police and the city council in order to get this initiative underway?
Well, so it helped to, first of all, hi, thanks for having us. Thanks for being interested in making space. My meditation teacher at that time, one of my meditation teachers at the time that Pauly was killed, was a retired captain of the Madison Police Department. And I had, you know, roots in the neighborhood and connections in the neighborhood from when I had lived there before. And with social, you know, folks who started the Social Justice Center. So that connection right there, I will say, that's privilege. Everything I just mentioned just now is privilege and those connections. And those people showed up within 48 hours and reached out to me and said, this isn't right. What happened here is not right. And especially Sherry Maples, who was a former captain of training and personnel and almost a police chief at MPD. Sherry said, this is not how we were trained. This is not correct. And so having that, and then Chief David Cooper came on board, and we had, you know, seasoned activists, an attorney, social workers, teachers, but all white. Everybody was white. And I will say that, I mean, that made sense to me, because I was like, well, why would we expect black residents come running because a white guy got killed by the police when this has been happening to them since the inception of the police,
right?
You know, since well before filming. So the reason why I think initially we were able to get people to sign our petition, and why, you know, we were able to create the community response team so quickly and launch a community meeting that involved, had every decision maker on a panel for the community to ask questions of, and all the people most impacted by Pauly's murder. We were on the panel as well. We were able to do that because of, you know, the folks who were in our group right off the bat. Sherry Maples is one main person that really, and Stephanie Rierich, pulled levers. The city council didn't listen to us. I really believe they weighed out, they knew what had happened was egregious. They knew it was horrible. The man who shot Pauly, the officer, Steve Hinesmith, had a very secure position on the police union board. The police union has significant political power in Madison, in Dane County. So I think that probably played a role. But the city council didn't, other than Alder Marsha Rummel, the rest of the alders, you know, and Rebecca wasn't an alder yet, but the rest of the alders just waited out. And they're like, we really don't have to do anything about this. We really don't.
But when Tony was killed then, that was 2015. I think what changed, according to what I read, is that Tony's fellow high school students and a lot of middle school students, too, came out in the thousands for a march and a protest in front of City Hall. Is that right? Do you think that forced the hand of the city council?
Well, that was huge. But what's interesting is I was talking to a beloved officer in the Madison Police Department who's African-American, and like kids on the street who are you know, economically challenged, perhaps making decisions that are, you know, making their lives more challenging. They love him. And this guy's well-trusted. And I told him, I said, you know, it's so interesting. What did you think? What did you think about the situation with Pauly? And he said, I couldn't believe it. And he said, but he was a wrong victim. And he said, in political community, you've got a wrong victim and a right victim. Excuse me. the right victim is someone who will energize those who are elected. The wrong victim is someone that they believe they can ignore. And so that, when you look at Polly, he was the wrong victim in this situation, and especially because white people inherently trust police, right? Most white people believe the police work for them because they do. You know, most of the land is owned by white people, and so they're just like, if the police did it, it must have been the right thing to do. He must have had it coming. There's that issue, right? For Tony Robinson, I think his age, I think that the timing, we have a different police chief at that point. It's not Chief Ray, who is African-American. It is Michael Koval, who was a loose cannon. And Tony had a ton of community in the high schools, like his siblings had community. And it energized Young Gifted and Black, Freedom Inc., who are trusted by a lot of these young people, this youth. And they organized and electrified the community, to, you know, filled the streets, and were able to identify real movement on the part of our elected officials versus pacification. So as we've seen over the last 6 months, pacification is taking a knee for a photo op. Pacification is holding a Black Lives Matter sign or putting it in your window suddenly. Pacification is saying, we hear you, marching with the protesters. But Freedom Inc. and Young Gifted and Black were able to, which is now Urban Triage, and Matt Bronkin has gone on to do other things. They were able to, you know, convey to these kids and to people in the streets that, do you see what they're doing? This is pacification. They're doing nothing. This is all they've done since peaceful protests began. What we want them to do is shift resources so that kids like Tony have all the opportunities that people who are not Black and not oppressed have. And they said, that's when we know they're hearing us. That's when we know they're not pacifying us. When they actually listen to and act on the requests of the peaceful protester, then we'll know. And the requests that they had were, number one, we want accountability. We want an objective. And this is what we were asking for in 2012 as well. We want an objective investigation. We want an investigation done by people who have no stake in the outcome. So in other words, no police officers, right? We want that in addition. We want justice. This was a murder. This was a life taken. This was an officer who had already killed somebody and an officer who was told to wait. This was an officer who clearly didn't remember what had happened because his story was forensically impossible. So they're saying, we want justice. His story doesn't add up. They were saying, and we want you to shift all the funds that you have put into the police department, which has essentially allowed this entity, this institution, to fulfill its potential and, you know, to the extent of its purpose. We want you to shift that to education, public health, you know, and programming so that we can see what our communities look like when those entities reach their full potential, when those entities are actually serving the Black community. Because we can't possibly judge their success if we don't fully fund them and allow them to bloom. And they've been asking for that. They were saying that in 2015. So we've had 5 years of peaceful protest urging our politicians to fully fund root cause, entities that address root cause, so that they can get those names out of the 911 queue, so they can get those names off assistance. And it's the most rational, intelligent, forward-thinking, compassionate, request that could ever be made of our elected officials and the taxpayers in this regard. The other path that we've been on is a trajectory of doubling our prison size, doubling the amount of Black people in them, and doubling law enforcement. So we all know that's a failing system. It totally fails. If we care about Black, Indigenous people of color, that system is a failure as is. So
yeah. I read the blog that the chief Kovo posted, and his argument was that the study was costing too much money. They could have put more officers on the street, which of course begs the question, more officers doing the wrong thing is not going to help the community at all.
Yeah, and more often, every good officer knows they're operating on the job and off the job to render themselves obsolete. They should be working and lobbying to not be needed anymore, because we know a healthy community that has resources needs police far less than communities that are left behind. So Chief Koval's answer, if that was Koval or Wall or whoever it was, is one that it's literally like if you live on a river and bodies are piling up of drowned people, okay, and you just keep paying someone to come and pull them out and get rid of them so that your house doesn't flood, rather than investing in figuring out why are people drowning in the first place. And so anyone who wants to continue investing in just getting people out so their house doesn't flood, those people can't be in power anymore. I mean, we got to make sure that they have power over no one and continue trying to assist them in developing an analysis that will heal our communities and society. But the idea that we could have had more cops on the street, okay, well, are we trying to achieve North Korea level security? Are we going to have an officer every block? I mean, what's the goal here? Sure, you could have an officer in every house, but is that America? Is that what we want? Or do we want to actually address this in an epidemiological way? We want to take a cure of violence approach, right? We want to fully fund our education, fully fund prevention, violence prevention. And people are terrified of that. They're terrified of it. But they shouldn't be, because we see in communities, we see in societies around the world where prevention is the priority and building people in health, they have far less crime. They have far less violence. They have a much healthier population.
So the report has been completed. Your recommendations have been made. How far along on the implementation are you, Amelia? How long do you think that this might take?
It depends on council. And it depends on, obviously, the two pieces that were passed last week are critical for oversight for the implementation of the rest of the recommendations. And we knew that the police union would fight those the hardest. When those will be up and running is, we're hoping in the next few months, right?
Which ones were the most contested? I know that you asked for a civilian review of the employment and personnel records for the police officers. Which ones did the police give you the hardest time about?
The Civilian Oversight Board really bothered them because they didn't like a number of things. They don't like the fact that this board can have, they don't like the makeup of the board, right? So at least half the board has to be Black. And a significant portion of the board has to have lived experiences with law enforcement, economic challenges, housing security challenges, or housing insecurity, I should say. They have to have lived experiences that often land people in the 911 queue, right? Or often draw the attention of law enforcement, make them a target. So, poverty. That freaks people out, right? So that freaked the police department out, because they're like, well, those people hate us. There are people in their own police department who have had these experiences. There are people that, and not to mention, like, these people don't need to be educated on what the police do, because they know, because they've interacted with the police quite a bit. So that concerns them, right? They don't want these people who have not had a seat at the table to have a seat at the table. And a table that is not going to suffer regulatory capture because you have officers at that table, or you have lawyers at that table, or you have, now there could be a lawyer there, but not because they're a lawyer. It could be because, these other reasons, these other experiences, and they happen to be a lawyer. But the police are terrified that this board will cast an ugly shadow on them. And they're terrified of the fact that this board can both conduct investigations and subpoena people. I mean, it likely is the most powerful civilian oversight board in the country. But what we pointed out, you know, several times is that of the seven entities that conduct review and investigations of the Madison Police Department, this will be the only one that doesn't have an officer who's retired in the last 5 years, that doesn't have an officer, that doesn't have, you know, like obvious friends of the police department and conflicts of interest, you know. But they're still terrified, even though they have these six other entities, Police and Fire Commission, the union, the DA, the DCI, right, their internal affairs department, and the police chief. They have all those that always rule in favor of them and have vested interest in ruling in favor of them, or they're in trouble, right?
Right.
But they're terrified, this one group that can't even make binding decisions because they're afraid of what they might find out, you know, just like Chief Ray and Chief Koval. So the other, they were terrified of what they might find out in their department because they really don't know what's going on. So the other piece, the other part of that recommendation was the internal monitor. And that person is going to be independent of the mayor's office. They're going to have their own department, and they're going to work with the Civilian Oversight Board to, conduct these investigations, to hear complaints, and to make recommendations for changes. The police department attempted to gut the description of the internal monitor position so that they could have a retired officer on there. Because again, I mean, could anything look more suspicious? I mean, it's just crazy. So they were unsuccessful in that because it's absurd. It's an absurd request, and it's an absurd effort. It looks awfully suspicious. But those two were passed, and now the next main focus, I think, is going to be on mental health mobile response. And what you'll see a lot of people who are unapologetically, like unconditionally pro everything law enforcement does, and law enforcement will respond to this by saying, oh, there's a murderer, there's someone murdering someone over on State Street, send a social worker. So they'll, you know, make fun of it. Their reviews will be filled with hyperbole. But in fact, a firefighter addresses fire and an officer comes as support. There are so many calls in the 911 queue that don't rise to the level of
pull your gun and shoot somebody.
Yeah, that's someone that needs an immediate officer response. So they don't get a response, you know, for 20 minutes, maybe. Like one example was Michael Schumacher at the end of my street. My neighborhood happens to be the one where, you know, there's been the most officer involved fatalities in the last, you know, 10 years, 12 years. Michael Schumacher is one of those people. He was in the water in the lake with all of his clothes on, splashing around, talking to himself. That's a low level call to MPD, right? Or a guy who's drunk sitting in a bush, kind of yelling at people.
I want to let some of our callers ask questions. Rebecca and Gisela, if you want to take some of these, that's fine too. If you're interested in asking a question of any of these women, please raise your hand by pressing number 1 on your phone keypad, and we'll get some questions up. Have you been asked to consult with other cities? Rebecca?
Not yet. We haven't been. But I think it's like brand new news that we've passed really the most robust civilian oversight of police. So I expect as our new board and as, you know, interested council members start to engage in a larger community of community oversight boards, there's, you know, national associations of them. I expect that we will be. And what's great about our situation is that we have so many people like Amelia and Gisela and others in our community who are now experts. I mean, you can listen to Amelia talk for hours, and she'll, you know, I still listen to her, and she has something new to say, and a new spin on things, because, you know, a beloved friend of hers was murdered right in front of her house, and so her life for the last 8 years has been this. And, you know, I would just say, if, you know, if there's anyone on the call who's feeling that jolt of electricity and energy to do something about it, you know, I'm sure I will volunteer Amelia or Diesel or myself or any of us in Madison to, you know, to talk to you or record with you. Because...
Thank you. Darian has a question up. She's our U.S. section president. Go ahead, Darian.
Thank you, and thank you very much to both speakers. It's very encouraging that this will be one of the most, I guess you said, powerful citizens review boards in the country. At the same time, I'm pretty sure I heard you say that if its decisions won't be enforceable or something like that. And this seems to be a standing problem with citizens review boards, that they lack any teeth. So how are you planning to address that quandary in your case?
Well, one thing, this is Gisela, one thing that makes this particular oversight board and the internal monitor particularly powerful is that it has independence. It has independent investigatory powers, and it has independence from the police department and from the politics, the elite politics that govern our city. So that means that we will have, or whoever is the victim of the next tragedy will have the legal support behind them to do an independent investigation of their own and present that case to the Police and Fire Commission. Now, it may very well be that we still have to take to the streets to make sure that the Police and Fire Commission honors the opinion. But prior to this, I mean, the city paid for Matt Kinney's legal defense, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the person,
Tony, right?
Right. And nobody, I mean, a public, public defender, his first case, stood up for the family of Tony Robinson. And so that's not going to happen again. There are funds there. There are independent investigators there, so that at least their side of the story gets told. And then if the Police and Fire Commission doesn't honor that, we may have to do something to enforce it. There are also other recommendations in the whole of the 177 that are addressing the Police and Fire Commission as well. We want to change, right now, a police chief can be in office for the rest of his life. And we want to change that so that they can be elected. So if we have a bad one, we don't necessarily have to fight the whole system to get him out. It'll just come up at the next election. So there are a bunch of smaller recommendations that are adjustments in power, but hopefully will help with the problem overall.
Okay, our next question is from Robin Lloyd. Robin, go ahead.
Oh, okay, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm from Burlington, Vermont, and we're kind of in the throes of the decision making that you seem to have already completed. Just to say what's happening here right now, there are a number of people camped in at the park across from the police station. Happens that the police station is right next to Battery Park. And they are joined by college students, mainly women, for marches every night, especially on weekends. And there have been three, one death, and of a white man who was very angry at the hospital, and the policeman hit him, and he died two days later. He had other medical problems. And then two black men were assaulted by the police in different events. And one of them, maybe two of them, as far as I know, I don't know, has a traumatic head injury, and there's a lawsuit there. But, you know, Burlington is the headquarters of Bernie Sanders. So we have three parties, and we have six members of the city council out of 12 who are progressives. And they've convinced the whole city council to pass a resolution on racial justice through economic and criminal justice. That was in June. And it's included establishing a committee on reparations. So they are proposing a charter change to allow others than just the police chief to make disciplinary decisions. And they say, we will not support a union contract with the Burlington Police Officers Association. So so I sent them your information that Rebecca had sent me a couple of weeks ago. And I hope that, you know, they will be in touch with you as things develop here, because it seems as though you have developed some very interesting answers.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Gisella and Rebecca and Amelia. Rebecca joined us tonight from a vacation she's trying to take to get away from Madison work. And I think Amelia was also away, but calling in. So thank you so much. And we appreciate the work you're doing, and we'll keep checking out how it goes. Check in with us through the branch in Madison, and let us know how it's progressing.
Yes, and we're all honored to be invited. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.